Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, with me in the studio today is my faithful producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
Well, in some ways, I'm sad, but there's no comments today. But I think I'm happy because there's no comments today because I have a lot I want to cover. So now, for today's program, I want to continue discussing Candace Millard's book titled Hero of the Empire. Now, for those of you who are listening in for the first time, Miss Millard is a best-selling author whose books frequently appear on the New York Times bestseller list. She's a great historian. Books are very, very easy to read, and there's several of them out there that I could recommend to you. Now, on my last podcast, I discussed the elements from chapter one, and mainly in this section, it's called Pushful the Younger. Pushful the Younger. So we discussed the elements from chapter one, and really, if you look at it, mainly chapter one, is basically a repeat of what we've already read in my early life. So there's no need for us to really go back through all of that again. But last time I did cover mainly about the vast responsibilities of the British Empire. And she really did a wonderful job of explaining how great and how helpful the British Empire has been to many, many peoples in the world. And so I think that's really very, very good on her part. And, of course, we know that Winston Churchill loved the empire. He wanted to see it thrive. And later in his life, when he saw it falling apart, it was just disgusting to him. So anyway, if you get a chance, go back and listen to that one, because it really is very important about the British Empire. And then also, if you're really interested, you could write into the PCG website, and you could order Mr. Herbert Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That'd be a great book for you, and that's all free for you, to do that. But it would really give you the deep insight into that God prophesied the British Empire. Thousands and thousands of years ago, he prophesied that they were going to be a great power. And then he also prophesied that the United States would be a great empire. And so that's all in your Bible. And it's just really exciting. Now, for today's program, what I want to do is we're definitely going to stay in part one, Pushful the Younger. And I like to say that over and over again because sometime in the future, I want to meet Winston Churchill and I want to tell him what she said about him. Called him Pushful the Younger. So anyway. But now what I want to do is I want to go to chapter two of part one. And this one is called, the title of the chapter is The Graven Palm. Now, there's a lot in this chapter. She's just really, she can really put a lot together in a chapter. And so I'm going to read most of it, but then the title of the chapter is The Graven Palm. And that is something unique that I want to get to, but I want to get to the better stuff first. All right. So essentially what I'm going to be doing is, if you have your books, hopefully you have them, I'm going to start on page 20. And essentially what she's getting into is she's talking about Winston Churchill really working hard now to kind of like get ready to get out of the army, but to really become more of a political leader like his father was. And so that's what's going to come up here. So the very top of this chapter, she says, for Churchill, it was not enough to believe that power and fame would come eventually. As soon as the new year, and that was 1898, began, he set his sights on realizing not one daunting ambition, but three, daring the world to ignore him. And so we know that Winston Churchill, I mean, he believed a lot in himself, and he believed that he should be doing great things. Now, she goes on to say, he published his first book, The Story of the Malakin Field Force. So remember in previous issues, we talked about him becoming a writer. And, he wrote the story of the Malakin Field Force. It became a popular book. And the last couple of weeks, I actually bought a copy of it. You can still buy it. About the Malakin Field Force. It says he began agitating also. Now, he wrote that book as he was still in the army. But then he began agitating for an assignment to fight in the Sudan. Now, this we already covered some of this in my early life. But it's interesting here what she says about it. And he made it clear to anyone who would listen that despite his youth, he was not only eager to begin his political career, but eminently qualified to do so. So he really wants to get into politics. And he even wrote to his mother, he said, I am somewhat impatient of advice as to my beginning in politics. He complained to his mother soon after returning from Malakin. If I'm not good enough, others are welcome to take my place. Of course, as you have known for some time, I believe in myself. And he said, if I did not, I might perhaps take other views. So we know that Churchill did have a lot of vanity. He really did believe in himself. But then I really think that one of the good things about this chapter is he does go to the Sudan. And now what Miss Millard is going to do, she's going to tell us what happened there. And it is pretty interesting. All right, this bottom of page 20, she says, convinced that another war and another opportunity for heroism would be of use in his political life, Churchill recruited no less than the Prime Minister of Great Britain to help him win an assignment in the Sudan, where the British were trying to wrest power from the Mahdists. Following the Muslim leader, al-Hamadi, he set sail for Africa before the Indian army had even granted his leave. What he witnessed there would leave a lasting mark. He described the campaign in the River War, and I also have a copy of that book, by the way. It's about the Sudan. And the reason why I'm covering this today for you listeners is I wanted to cover it in my early life, but I also wanted to get finished with that book. And there's a lot about the Sudan that's not in that book. And so it's really kind of nice that she has done some of the work for me. She goes on to say, even years later, he described a nightmarish scene of death and dismemberment with horses spouting blood, struggling on their legs, men staggering on foot, fishhook spears stuck right through them, arms and faces cut to pieces, bowels protruding, men gasping, crying, collapsing, expiring. And so this was a horrible war, horrible conflict in Egypt. And it says Churchill himself shot and likely killed a half dozen men, one of whom was so close to him that the pistol itself struck the man as Churchill galloped by. So you can imagine, here he is in Egypt, he's galloping on a horse and he's killing people. And he shoots the one guy, slaps him in the face with his gun as he kills him. You know, anyway, Churchill was not afraid to fight. He had studied being a soldier since he was very young. He said, in fact, although the British ultimately prevailed, so horrific was that campaign that even for Churchill, war was finally beginning to lose a little of its gallant gleam. And so all of a sudden, you know, he's always wanted to go to war, wanted to go to the battle. After Durham, he was done with war. And he goes on to say, this is, she's quoting him. He says, "You cannot gild it." He wrote to his mother from Khartoum, "The Ra comes through." And so finally, I think, at Sudan, is Churchill finally got sobered up about war. She goes on to say, as sobering as Churchill had found the carnage he witnessed in the Sudan, his faith in himself and his future had not for a moment been shaken. So I'm glad she brings that up. And we've talked about that in my early life is Winston Churchill really had faith in himself. He believed, you know, he was like Julius Caesar. You know, Julius Caesar told everybody he was the North Star. And, he really did have faith in himself, and he did have faith in his future. And he really believed that he was going to be used for big things. And, she goes on to say, on the contrary, he was acutely aware of the fact that once again, he had forced his way into the deadliest colonial battle the British Empire had to offer, watched as men all around him were killed and horribly wounded, and emerged not just alive, but whole. He didn't have any problems. And essentially what he wrote is, "Nothing touched me." He calmly wrote just 2 days after the Battle of Omdurum, I guess, in which the British had lost 500 men to death and injury, and the Mahdists lost 20,000 men. So that's why, the British war there was considered one of the greatest for the British. You know, and it is really interesting. Winston Churchill went on to say, "I destroyed those who molested me and so passed out with any disturbance of body or mind." So he was right in the thick of it. Now she goes on to say, and I think this is really interesting, this is in this chapter called The Graven Palm. "Churchill believed that whatever had kept him alive on the battlefield, whether divine intervention or simply good fortune, his luck had been set fair, and he was eager to rest, to test its indulgence. On what to do these things depend, he mused as a train carried him home. Chance, providence, God, the devil, call it what you will, whatever it may be, I do not complain." Now, that is a statement that he did make, talking about providence or the devil. And the thing is, he did change that opinion later. And he really did come to believe that God had protected him over all these years to really prepare him to help, well, with World War I and World War II. And so, you know, he did save Western civilization. And but he does believe there was a spiritual force there. And she goes on to say, "Nor did he hesitate. As 1898 came to an end, so did Churchill's career as a soldier." And so that's important. He after Omdurum, he said, "I'm done." And then he decided to leave the army. Now remember, he was counseled not to do that. And then she goes on to say, although he was in considerable debt and had not been trained for any other occupation and had been warned against leaving the army by everyone, from his formidable grandmother, the Duchess of Marlborough, to the Prince of Wales, he resigned his commission in the British Army early in the new year. And so he was getting out of the army. But there was a reason, is he wanted to get into politics. That's why. It's not because he wanted to escape battles. He wanted to, you know, start his political career. He wrote to his cousin, Sonny Marlborough. He says, you know, "It won't be long." He says, "My papers are in, and in 3 months, I shall not be a soldier." That's what he wrote that to his cousin, Sonny Marlborough, in the weeks of 1899, confessing in a rare admission of uncertainty that he knew he was taking a very great risk in leaving the army. But Churchill is known for taking a lot of risks. And so sometimes, you know, even we have to do that. Take a risk. You know, do something. Don't sit and cry. Do something. He said, "It is not without some misgivings that I let go of my tow rope," he wrote. and commit myself unaided to the waves of life's oceans, propelled only by my own machinery, he would not have to tread water for long. So one of the things about Winston's writing, he was really kind of poetic. You know, he was really good at that. And then she goes on to say, this is page 22 now. In early April, when the spring rains were lashing at London's cobblestone streets, still had the bite of winter, Churchill approached the entrance to the House of Commons. So can you believe this? He's out of the army. He's back in London. And he decides, I'm going to go visit the House of Commons. You know, so he's got some crust. He said, he walked into the House of Commons. It was a wide Gothic archway cut into the imposing stone face of the Palace of Westminster. Looming hundreds of feet above him, its reflection wavering in the ruffled surface of the River Thames, was the clock tower, one of the most immediately recognizable architectural structures in the world. Now, I've had a chance to be in England several times, and it's still amazing to go into London and see the clock tower and to see Westminster. And, you know, it's just an amazing, amazing thing. It's a big landmark. He said the tower, which was only 15 years older than Churchill himself, was famous not just for the great clock, but for its nearly 14-ton bell, named Big Ben, most likely in honor of Ben Condt, a 6'2", 200-pound bare-knuckle boxer who had been the heavyweight champion of England in 1841. I did not know that it's named after, a heavyweight champion. So, and again, it just shows that Winston Churchill, when he put his mind to something, he was going to do something. She goes on to say, as Churchill stepped into the shadow of Big Ben, he knew that waiting for him in the cool, hushed interior of the House of Commons was a man who could open the doors to his iconic seat of political power. One of the two members of Parliament for the town of Oldham in the northwest of England, Robert Ashcroft, with his gray hair, full dark mustache, and fine features, not only looked more substantial and respectable than his young visitor, but seemed to be the embodiment of the old world dignity. And remember now, he really loved his father, and he was part of that old world dignity as well. He says there, as he led Churchill through the dimly lit halls and down the narrow stairs to the members-only smoking room, Ashcroft had a gravitas that Churchill, with his feverish ambition and blatant self-promotion, did not have, but they both hoped he could do without. So gravitas is essentially his dignity. It's a serious look, and Churchill came in like smart aleck. You know, that's the way he was. And that, she goes on to say, despite Churchill's youthful energy and awkwardness, when he stepped through the heavy doors that led into the smoking room, he easily slipped into a world that most Britons not only would never see, but could not even fully imagine. Although this was the House of Commons, more than half its members came from the British aristocracy. To most young men, the room alone, with its soaring ceilings, paneled walls, casually scattered chess tables, and curved wooden chairs upholstered in rich leather, tarnished brass tacks, would be imposing, even awe-inspiring. For Churchill, it was, in reputation at least, as familiar as his own childhood. Although this was not yet his world, it had long been his father's. And so the thing is he got out of the army, he survived the Sudan, and he was really dead set on starting his career in politics. And so he didn't waste any time. Okay, one other nice thing I think that Miss Miller does is she does talk about the problem in this chapter, the problem between Lord Randolph and with Winston. And essentially, I think she does a nice job of showing that there was a real problem there between, you know, a father and a son. She goes on and says, this is page 23 now, She goes on to say, Lord Randolph Churchill, the brilliant, talented, and arrogant third son of the 7th Duke of Marlborough, had had an extraordinary political career, made even more remarkable by the fact that he had lived to be only 45 years old. He had won his first seat in Parliament in 1874, the same year in which he married an American beauty named Jenny Jerome, and his first child, Winston, had been born. By the time he was 36, he was Secretary of State for India. A year later, the Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, appointed him leader of the House of Commons and Chancellor of the Exchequer, just one position below Salisbury himself. So you could see in some ways why Winston Churchill wanted to rise, because he had seen his father rise to the top. And a very, very well-known politician in England at that time. She goes on to say, although Churchill had never had the close relationship with his father that he longed for, he had been fiercely proud of Lord Randolph's public position and had dreamed of one day becoming, if not a trusted advisor, at least a help to him in his meteoric career. So you can see that Winston really wanted to help his dad. He wanted to support him and help him, but his dad didn't want him. He didn't want him to be there. He said, to me, Churchill would write years later, he seemed to own the key to everything or almost everything worth having. He would never forget walking down the street as a child and watching men doff their hats in respect as his father passed by. He scanned the papers hungrily, reading every mention of Lord Randolph's name, every quotation from his speeches, every word of criticism or admiration. Everything he said, even at the tiniest bazaar, was reported verbatim in all the newspapers. Churchill would probably recall every phrase being scrutinized and weighed. He said, when at Harrow, and we all remember those back to my early life, when at Harrow, the public school he attended as a boy, Churchill had repeatedly begged his mother to send him not just his father's autographs, but even her own, so that he could give or perhaps sell them to his classmates. So he was selling his dad's pictures, and his mom's pictures to make some money on the side. So what a character. So Lord Randolph's career, however, had been as brief as was blazing. The darling of democracy, one contemporary writer called him, a wayward genius who flashed across the political firmament like a dazzling meteor burning himself out too soon. Famously outspoken and sharp-tongued, he had from the beginning of his tenure as Chancellor of the Exchequer publicly and unapologetically disagreed with many of the other members of Lord Salisbury's administration. When his first budget was rejected, Randolph, in a cold rage, had written Salisbury a letter of resignation, confident that it would not be accepted. It was. He resigned. They resigned him. Years later, Churchill's mother could still vividly recall her son's horror and that of Randolph's private secretary, A.W. Moore, when they realized what he had done. Mr. Moore, who was devoted to Randolph, rushed in, pale and anxious, she wrote, and with a faltering voice said to me, and this is his mom saying this, he has thrown himself from the top of the ladder. Not only would Randolph never rise again, he would die 8 years later, following a long, frightening, and excruciatingly public mental decline. And so Winston saw his dad go down. She goes on to say, I think I'm going to skip this one. You can read this for yourself. Page 24, the last paragraph, talks a little bit about, some of the other political characters around Randolph. Now, I'm going to go to the top of page 25, and this might be really surprising to you, and I'm going to go to there's one paragraph at the top, then there's a smaller one. It says, it went against every instinct Churchill had to sit still and wait to be called to the test. Desperate to do something, he decided that although he had faith in his star, it couldn't hurt to peer into the misty future to make sure it was still shining. He was not without connections in this unusual area of expertise. The year before, his American aunt, Leonie Jerome, had taken him to a mysterious little house on Wimpole Street in West End of London, just one block from the lushy green and stubborn round Cavendish Square. This was home, at least temporarily, to Miss Charlotte Robinson, arguably the most famous palm reader of her day. That's why the chapter is called The Graven Palm. So Churchill, he had to know what his future was, and his aunt helped him in this. So it's really kind of surprising to me. But listen to this, everybody. It says, although Victorian era is most often associated with scientific progress, the establishment of scientific principles, the advancement of medicine, the development of railroads, steamships, telephones, radios, even the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, it was also a time of growing interest and belief in mysticism. Attempting to look into the future and to make contact with the spiritual world was considered a serious pursuit by everyone, from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to the editors of the prestigious magazine Scientific American, who sponsored a contest among mediums to see who could show conclusive psychic manifestations. Even Queen Victoria and her husband Prince Albert had taken part in seances, and when Albert died in 1861 of typhoid fever, the Queen had invited to Windsor a 13-year-old boy who claimed the prince had sent her a message through him during a family seance. So to me, that was shocking. And that's why this chapter is called The Graven Palm. So I'm not saying I support seances. I'm not saying I support palm readers, but it is interesting. So unfortunately, that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we're going to continue to discuss Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 1. And we will still be in this section, section 1. It's titled Pushful the Younger, Chapter 2. And so we're going to finish Chapter 2. It really gets fascinating. And so if you can read ahead, it's fine. And but anyway, this book, I think, is really, really good book. And it does discuss not only the Boer War, which we're going to get into not too long in the future, and then this we're going to be really starting very early on now, Churchill's rise to great leadership. And so, again, it's a wonderful compliment to Winston Churchill's My Early Life. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And then you can also buy Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com, or you could probably find a good, inexpensive copy at abebooks.com. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.